Well, we like to start on time here, as is our custom, and so good evening and welcome to the first presentation in this, our 12th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster taking pictures back here, Hai Wong Wan, and our research instruction coordinator back in the blue, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist is Shadon Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of Cave City, Kentucky. He attended schools in Park City before moving to Barron County High School, and growing up he wanted to be an attorney, and was influenced by his mother and father, Ernest and Imogene Dossie. Upon graduation, he enrolled in WKU's College of Business, from where he received a Bachelor of Science in Business in 1986, and moved to Paducah. He spent a decade in Dallas, Texas, before moving back to Paducah, where in 1994, he joined the Western Rivers Corporation, a large insurance agency serving 5,000 clients, which specializes in commercial insurance for business owners with a staff of 24 in offices in Paducah and Murray, Kentucky, of which he's currently the president. 15 years ago, he and his wife June founded the Purple Toad Winery on 25 acres near Paducah, Kentucky, where they began growing Cab Sauvignon, Cab Franc, Pinot Noir, Merlot, Chardonnay, Riesling, and blackberries. And the winery opened for business for the first time on July 1st, 2009. Over the past 6 years, the winery has won 300 state and regional awards for its wines. They continue to expand operations, and the wine is now sold in 4 states, Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, and Tennessee. In 2014, it was being sold in 170 stores in Kentucky. It's now the second largest winery in the state of Kentucky. The Dossies have continued to develop their property and now host special events like weddings, birthdays, charitable fundraisers, and even music concerts. When not running an insurance company or making wine, Alan enjoys scuba diving, the beach, stained glass, golf, and of course his family. Please give a warm welcome to Alan Dossie. Alan? Well, thank you everybody for coming tonight. We'll do a little history. We'll go through the Purple Toad, how it originated, things of that nature. We'll have a few slides of the transition of the company in the last 5 years, which has really been most of the growth. So we'll get started a little. In general, what happened in the industry in the 1880s, the United States started beating the French in their wines, so they started importing some of our vines. They didn't realize that we had a disease that was inherited in the United States called phylloxera. It attacked the roots. They looked for a solution. They ended up grafting on American rootstock. So if you go to France now, 95% of all the grapes you'll see over there are the vines. The bottom part below, 4 inches above the ground and below, will be American rootstock. And above that will be the Merlots, the Cabernets, things of that nature. So it's been a transition. Most of the winemakers you see in France or Italy or Spain actually migrated from France during this period. They were essentially out of work, so they lost 90%. We grow mostly vinifera, which are the same vines. All of our vines are grafted on American rootstock. There's different types of rootstocks that do better with different types of soils. In this part of the area, they use a rootstock called 3303, and it's more of a limestone-based rootstock. And then in our area, we use 10114, which is more of a sandy clay soil. But it kind of gives you a background. So if you go to my vineyard right now, you'll see a knot about 4 inches above the ground, and that's where they grafted them on. In general, what happened for us, we started 15 years ago. We took a trip to Napa, and I grew up on a farm here in Cave City, and I just loved it. And the farming aspect of it is just a little different. We had all the normal cows, corn, everything you had, horses. But
growing the grapes just had a different flavor to it. So we started out with that. I did a bunch of research. I wanted to see what kind of vines could grow in this climate in Kentucky. The difference between there and here in general, they have a dry climate. They fight dry molds. And here, of course, it rains, and it rains. So we have a wet fungus that we fight. The things you use to fight them are very similar, but that's the main challenge here. But when I did my research, I was told I couldn't grow Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Riesling, Pinot Noir, or Merlot in this climate. And of course, that made me want to do it, so that's what I put out. I'm a little hard-headed. But when you do the research, we're essentially parallel to Napa Valley. You can go straight across, and of course, really the difference is humidity and the rainfall. We started those after about a year of research. We put our first planting out. We put out 1,000 plants to start. So that's a lot of plants to start with, start planting. But we did that. We nurtured them through the first 3 years. In general, what you do with your crop, and you have to water them until they get to about 3 to 4 years old. And the thing you see with them is that after that, when all the soybeans, the corn, things of that nature are all drying up, they're green as can be, and they love dry weather. So a couple years ago when we had the drought, that was perfect weather. We had one of the best crops we've ever had. But we have to spray them. Most of the work is hand-based, so you do spray them with a tractor and a sprayer behind it, but everything else is like training roses. So you go through and you have to tuck them, you have to trim them, you have to prune them, you have to keep the bugs off of them, you keep the moisture off of them. So it's a challenge, but it's one I really like doing. So we'll start a little with the purple toad, how it kind of originated. A lot of people always asked, I'm a sales guy. You have to understand half of your job is marketing, the other half is making the wine. So we have almost 70 wineries in Kentucky. So you need a mix, or you need two different people or a group of people to do both. But what we end up doing is you look for a name that no one else has. So you go through all the names, you go on the internet, and they're taken. You go name after name, thousands of names, and you find someone else has it. So you always want something different. End up being, everybody's seen the Lucy show when they're pressing with their feet. If you look 200 or 300 years ago, they pressed most of the grapes with their feet or something of that nature, and their toes would be purple. So we really started out with T-O-E apostrophe D. I've got 22 ladies at work, and they're kind of my tasters, my name. I run my label by. The reason that most of the time, if the female is the consumer or she's the purchaser. So she's about 82% of your market for your wine. So you need to do your homework. So they're either buying it off the shelf or they're consuming it. So most of the things I run by with them, and it really makes a difference. And I had one of my secretaries tell me that, it sounds like dirty feet. So we changed it. It became toad, T-O-A-D at that time. We were always going to have an animal on our label. Everybody's seen yellowtail. Well, yellowtail, you know, has a kangaroo on there and has special design. Well, it gets it off the shelf. So there's a reason. You'll end up with 7 to 11% more sales getting it off the shelf the first time. So you always look for something attractive. We came up with a Costa Rican tree frog. With doing that, this is our starting point. This is one of the original pictures I've got my idea from. And then you'll see the transition as we go forward. This is another tree frog, Costa Rican tree frog again. If you notice on the first one, the eyes were blood red. One of my Judy ex in my office told me, I don't like the real bloody looking eyes. So she said, so we changed that. So everything's, you know, do a little marketing, you know. So This is another idea of a little tree frog. You see how tiny they are. But if you look at their eyes, they are really red, really red. But they got orange little toes. So we have purple toes. So this is another example of a tree frog we based it off of. So, and there's the finished product. So if you go through it, you notice it's very similar. The markings on it are semi-similar. But the toes are purple, so the eyes are the same wine color also. So we've gone through this, but that gives you an idea of the transition starting point and the ending point on our label. And this is the main thing we have. Yeah, it's catchy. People enjoy it. The women like the little tree frog, even though it's not a toad. We took a little liberty there, but that's what that is. The next thing, everybody was talking about purple toes. Here's my hands. Usually my nails are terrible. This is after blackberry. It's one of the biggest staining things we do. But if I'm working in blackberry, my hands are going to be purple for a couple days. So it'll give you a little idea where we're going. This is the start of the vineyard. You can't really see the graftings right now, but we had people, as you notice, it's got all the grow tubes on it, and it looks like a pet cemetery. So you would not believe how many people ran by our place and go, is that a pet cemetery? And it's a starting planting of our vines. These right now, that is probably about 4 months old. You can see they're already starting to come out of the grow tubes. Here's another picture, just a different angle. That's actually our Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc there. But we till the soil up real well. The main trick on that a lot of guys miss is we have a hard pan of clay about a foot and a half down. Here it's mostly limestone. But you can actually make pottery out of it. But it's about an inch and a half thick, and you got to permeate that. And if you break that with some type of digging device, use subsoil or something of that nature, you'll break through it, you give the vines a chance to grow through it, and then it will actually close again on you. So if you come back and put new plants in later on, if you don't break the soil, they won't get through the clay. And that's one thing. They'll go up to 10, 13 feet deep, something of that nature. This is the first bud of spring. This is about as glamorous as it gets for us. So you can tell it's not very glamorous. This is the first two buds of spring. If you kind of look, and
this thing works.
This is the first bud. This first bud here is actually will be grapes in the future. This is 70% of your crop on the vinifera. This bud here is your second bud. So a lot of people, you always hear about Napa fighting the frost. They have the helicopters, things of that nature. They're trying to fight the frost on the early spring. If you damage the first bud, you'll lose 70% of your crop. If you damage the second bud, you'll lose the 30% that's remaining. So it's a challenge, and that's what they fight. We're in Paducah. It's a little easier for us to grow. We're around 4 to 7% or 4 to 7 degrees warmer than it is in Lexington, Louisville. This year they had a devastating cold front. It went and it destroyed over 40% of their crop this year. So it didn't just destroy their crop. It destroyed all of their plants and they died. Good technology. So we had no damage this year. This part of the state is perfect for this. You can go from Paducah over to Bowling Green and on east. This should be the best growing place for grapes in the country, in Kentucky. So we have an advantage. 3 to 5 degrees doesn't sound like much. -7 will kill these plants. They'll die all the way down to the roots. So that's the trick you're trying to watch. They got to -15 in Lexington, Covington area this year. So they had a tough winter. This is full bloom. So everybody like to see the flowers. This is as bloomy as it gets. Yeah, so this is it. They are actually self-pollinating. So everybody talked about the bees and things of that nature. they do not pollinate the grapes. They're self-pollinating. And the trick is, too, that if you notice the little flowers, the little white part, is so small, a bee cannot do anything with them anyway, but they are self-pollinating. The major danger there for us is lots of rainfall, because it'll wash the pollen out. That's the... We have six varieties that are at the winery, and this year it rained when the Cabernet Franc was in bloom for almost 7-8 days in a row. So we had a lesser crop than normal from that this year. This is the vines. They're about 2 years old here. Each year you prune them down to zero, and I'll show you a few more pictures in a minute. But this is Chardonnay in May. This is how much they grow. They're big weeds. This is, probably about only 3 weeks later from that other picture. That's how much they'll grow. Some of them will grow up to 12, 13 feet. We actually go through, and everybody did their hedges with the trimmers. You actually hedge them to keep them under control. This is at full maturity. This was actually taken a couple of years ago. And if you'll notice the front ones, they have a little rounded look to them. They're really neat. They all have the bird netting on them. That's one of the obstacles we have, is birds like the fruit a lot. A lot. They are pesky. And what they don't damage, what they don't eat, they'll damage and throw it on the ground. So that's your challenge. So you have to net all the vines. This is some of the rows. This is this year. You can see we've got them trimmed up, everything. You access them. You really want to orient your vines east to west. You want the wind to blow down the middle of them. That way they get the most drying with the wind. You keep them trimmed. You need 15 leaves to ripen a bunch of grapes. And so anything above that is just wasted. But you try to keep your leaves and everything as thin as possible so the air go through and dry all your grapes. And this takes a lot of work, and that's not a lot of fun doing that part. This is all just on a foggy day. I got out one morning on the way to work and took this. So that's just another picture of the opposite direction. And that's where we live there. This is dormant season. You can barely tell. The first row we've just pruned. So if you notice right here, everything is cut back. You essentially do 16 buds on these things. You do 8 on one side. You do 8 on the other side. They're approximately 6 inches apart, and that controls your fruit level. One of the things you'll run into is with your Concords and some of the other American grapes, people will have too much fruit on them. A grapevine can only ripen so much, and so you need to cut some of the fruit off. That's the thing a lot of the amateurs don't understand. If you overfruit it, they won't go to ripeness. So you've got to control the fruit level. And this is how we do it. We do it in the pruning portion. This is another view. You can barely see it, but there's two buds remaining. Your first bud and your second bud. And that's how you control your fruit. But you can see they're about a hand width apart. This is the ice storm of 2009. We had 2.5 inches of solid ice. If you look out to the end, you can barely see, but every electric pole for 2.5 miles was on the road. So, but it did not damage the vines. They didn't care. Everybody hears about, but as long as you didn't go and hit them when they were frozen, you were okay. If you hit them, it would break the vine because they were froze solid, but 2.5 inches of ice. And there's another one. See some of the sickles off of this. That is... what you do when you camp in the winter in January. So we had no electric, no nothing. 5 o'clock comes very early, and it is dark for a long time. So it's a little different. This is what we do before trimming. And we showed a picture a while ago. But in January, you have to go through and keep these trimmed up. And like I said, they'll grow like monsters. And American vines will actually grow almost double what these will. So these are actually more controlled. So those guys have a bigger challenge than we do. This is after you get done. See the difference? But we'll go through now once we got this under control, and we'll keep them trimmed within 6 inches or so of this. And all your fruits within your first foot you come up, you tee them off, and within a foot of that, all your fruit's hanging right there. This is some of the Pinot Noir grapes. This is the only grape that I grow that I would not suggest anybody else to try. If someone sprays weed killer a half a mile away, you can tell it. Anybody ever seen the accordions fans you have in a church? That's what the leaves will do. So if you go out and see leaves and they look like accordions and they got ripples through them, then somebody sprayed either 2,4-D or Roundup within some period and a little wind. So it's a challenge. But the main thing on Pinot Noir, if you drink Pinot Noir in general, it's a light wine. Usually you don't have a real deep red color. The reason is the grapes are right against each other, and the back third of the grape is actually white because it's touching the other grapes. They're really tight. They have a lot of fungus exposure because they're so tight and they don't dry as well. But that's a challenge. I think we're the only one that grows them in this part of the country. I had another guy put them in, and then after 2 years he took them out because they wouldn't survive for him. The Merlot, the Cabernets, all that, they're a little tricky, but they can be managed. This is Merlot. They are gorgeous grapes. If you go pick the grapes, these are the best tasting grapes off the vine. Everybody go to the grocery, you get a set of grapes. We measure sugar in bricks, so they're about 15 bricks is what they are in the grocery. We harvest these at 22 bricks. That's how much sweeter these are. So they are just delicious when you're ready to pick. And the reason you do 22, when you put the yeast in and the fermentation, the ratio drops down. It's a 0.55 ratio, but in general, you'll get 12% alcohol. So that's what you're after. This is Chardonnay. This does very well in this part of the country. Nice white grape. It's actually the number one selling wine made in the United States. This is a Merlot again, big, long. And they can be 8, 10, 12 inches long. They're very big. This is us during harvest. We have our buckets going out, and I kind of cheat. I've got one of those little carts you sit on and ride across ways. Most of them have a bucket or something they sell, but I cheat that way. And this is some of the Pinot Noir we picked recently. This is actually this year. We had one of the best harvests we've ever had this year, except for the Cab Franc, which we didn't have as good a fruit set, as much fruit on the vines this year because of the weather. This is after it goes through a crusher and destemmer. We don't press them the old way for feeding anymore. We've got equipment that does it. It makes the customers a little happier, especially my big feet. They don't want my feet in it. But this machine here, actually, you can put 10 to 15 ton an hour through this thing, which is a lot of grapes, and it'll kick the stems out one end, and it breaks the grapes. One of the things that we do that's a little different, we keep a lot of whole grapes in our fermentation vats. We keep about 25% of complete grapes. It tends to give a little more flavor to us. We get a little more color off of them, and it's one of our little, not a big trade secret, but that's one way we keep our wines a little fresher. This is the Riesling here, and this is one of our loads. We have a little trailer. My brother-in-law brings his four-wheelers. We load this thing up and run up to the crusher destemmer, and then we go back and load them up again. We usually start picking as early as possible. You want to pick before they warm up. As soon as you pick a grape, it starts degrading. So if you go to Napa or something like that, they'll start 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. We usually start about 6 o'clock. That's about when daylight gets there. It's, you know, you got a little dew on the vines and things like that. But, you know, they're still cool. And then we get them picked into the winery as quick as we can. This is the starting point of our winery. This is a very basic. This is year one. We actually built the building ourselves, me and the brother-in-law, so we try to do a little of everything. This is 3 years later, so a little transition. We've got the winery. Now we've got an open pavilion, seats about 190 people, and then we've got a warehouse on the end. So we've added, you know, a little more there. And we've enclosed the front of the winery, so it's a little more transition. This is the latest one, 2014. You can't see the back of it. We just doubled our fermentation room. So we went from around 12,000 gallons to 25,000 gallons we can hold on hand right now. And if we sell 25,000 this year, that'll make us number two and close to number one. So we're growing. This year we're growing about 40% over last year. And last year we grew about 60% over the year before. So we're growing, still growing. The middle part you can tell, the pavilion, it's enclosed. We put glass doors in it. And what that did is forklifts can go in and out, but it's also, we have, it's heat and air conditioned now, so we have a lot of weddings, parties, things of that nature. So as we transition, that will actually become storage. The intent is we're going to build a main winery up on top of the hill. We bought some more land. So that's the long term, and that's going to be up to Stephen a little later on, so give him something to do. This is one of the weddings we had outdoor. We have a lot of outdoor weddings. We've been lucky so far. We've only had one that got rain, which I don't know how, but they've been lucky because that's a tough thing. There we go. This is one of the indoors. They were in the pavilion. So, you know, everybody can decorate where they like, but some of them are very basic and some of them are very elaborate. So. And we have as small as 15, 20 people, and we have as big as 450 people. So it just varies by what they do. This is some of our new tanks in our fermentation room. They don't have the plastic off right now. Those are 2,250-gallon tanks. I don't know how many people. Anybody know what a fifth is? It's a fifth of a gallon. Until I got into the business, I didn't know it was a fifth of a gallon. So five of these little bottles makes a gallon. I didn't realize that until I got into it. These are 11,000 bottles each. These are only four of them, I think, right there. We've got eight right now of these, and we just added two more a couple weeks ago, so it's growing. This is my son. He's next to two of the 1,600, so they're 8,000 bottles. Then two of the 11,000 bottles are behind him, to give you an idea. And we're growing. This is our bottling line. This is one of the best things we ever bought. We started out with a four-spout filler. It looked like a milking machine. You put four bottles under it, and it filled them up. And then you put them on a table, and the person next to him had a bowl of corks, and he hand-corked the first 75,000 bottles. So... and my son's arm got bigger. I was a labeler. So it took us 4 hours with a little cleanup to do 100 cases. Four people. That was four. As fast as we could go. No breaks. No stopping. That's as fast as we could go. I got to where I could label a case of wine in 38 seconds. So you learn. You see how bored we were. Yeah. Who could beat this? Who can do that? That's kind of how the game worked. This little toy here, it's Italian, which all the tanks and stuff are. That thing does 130 cases an hour. Two of us can run it, full speed. So that's 1,604 bottles an hour. 12 bottles to a case. So that has been a savior. I sweated a lot to buy it because it was quite a bit of money and I don't like spending money. So I'm a little tight, but... that's worth every penny. So we're pretty happy with that thing. This is another picture of it. In general, what you do with this, the operator, they'll put empty bottles on them. The bottles come in upside down, so there's not dust in them. So you flip them upside down, and they go through, and they're upright then. They'll go through the machine, and there's two nitrogen tanks to the left, which you can't see. And they spray nitrogen in. Oxygen's your enemy. Oxygen oxidizes your wine or rust it. So you try to keep all the oxygen you can off of it. The first stage is it puts nitrogen in, fills the bottle. Second stage, it's like a merry-go-round. It fills it. You slightly overfill it. Feds don't like it underfilled or overfilled, so you got to be nice to them or they're not nice to you. And then the next stage, you come in and got a leveler, so it levels it right on the fed level. 750 milliliters is what we normally fill on these, or a fifth. And then you go through the corker. It actually sprays nitrogen in again in the airspace just above the fluid, then puts a cork in, and it goes outside of that. It goes to the capsule. It just blows the capsule on it. It looks like a hairdryer, but it comes down, and it's around 450 degrees. So it heat shrinks this capsule in less than half a second, and goes through there, and then it goes to the labeler. My labeler makes a little noise, goes zzz, zzz, and it's done. Front and back, and it's just one within 1 millimeter of each other. I mean, this thing can really. And then somebody on the end will actually take them out and put those in a box, and then we'll either put them in a stroller or to a pallet. So, but this is a nice toy. I got a lot of guys like to have one of these. This is part of the crew. The one on the left, my daughter, she's my oldest. She actually has my distributor's license in Kentucky. Like I said before, we're in 170 stores. We're growing. We add 1 to 2 stores almost every week. We get phone calls, so we're on the lucky end of this. Instead of having to beat the doors down, they actually are calling us. So the demand's been really good for it. My wife's in the middle, and then, of course, the big me in the end. This is my son. This is the future. He's at Western right now. He's a junior. That's Merlot grapes, as you can tell. And he's goofing off with them, so he should be working, but he's not. But now he's going to get his degree here, and then he's going to come back and help me with the winery. So we're looking forward to that. And we hope to at some point be actually the biggest winery in this part of the country. So a lot of people go, I only want to be this big and that big. And, you know, if I can beat Gallo, I'd be glad to. I have no problem going. You know, if we can get there, that's all right. This is the Toadmobile, we call it. So this is our moving billboard. We just got this within the last year. So we do most of the deliveries through my daughter through the distributorship. And this goes to all of our stores. But we actually had some ladies, it was funny, one of my drivers was in it, and we had some ladies following him almost 70 miles wanting to see where he was going to stop. And he calls me on his phone, and he says, I got these ladies behind me. And I said, well, tell them the store's that way. So, you know, you have all these things. This is a new little venture we're trying. These are half bottles, 375 milliliters of plastic. They still have our blue bottles, which is one of our mainstays. But they fit in coolers. They're single serving in general. So there's a lot of people who, you know, they drink wine, the other party does not. So we just started doing these. The only problem with these, we had to hand fill these. They're the 4-spout filler hand turn the lock on, so they're a little challenge right now. This is some of our Christmas bottles. I'm always looking for something different. I really want a toad bottle, but I haven't found one. The Italians will make one, the Germans will make one, but they want about $50,000 for the mold to start up. So there's a little challenge. So I'm gonna wait a little while on that one. But these are our Christmas series. We got the Christmas trees. We got the Santa hat. We put on several of our labels, and then the far one's the green one. We have a bunch of other bottles we do, but we found these very popular gifts, things of that nature. This is a few more of them. The first one's the green one. The second one is Merlot syrup. As far as I know, we're the only one in the country that does it, but we actually sell a Merlot, a syrup made from Merlot, and it's there's no alcohol. So you put it on pancakes. We've got several restaurants that put it on cheesecake. It's amazing what the Merlot tastes like. It's very similar to a blackberry, which you'd never think, but you reduce it down, and it's very similar to a blackberry in taste. This is one of our Valentine's bottles. We found these. The challenge is always find something different. We tried to, you know, when the guys always interview, how you growing, how you doing this, I said, really, there's 3 techniques you got to do. You either got to be cheaper, you got to be different, or you got to be better. You got to pick one. And they all look at me and go, well, you got to pick one and decide what you're going to do, then go with it. So this is a few more of the bottles we've been playing around with. We also have a trumpet. The skull, which we didn't think wine would do well in a skull bottle. They really do. Yeah, so, you know, you just don't know. And this is our Black and Brews. This is our main strip. This is actually the number one selling wine made in Kentucky from a Kentucky winery. If you notice, he's got Band-Aids and a black eye, so he's all Black and Brews. You know, marketing. And this is the regular one. This is actually our black peach. Everybody goes, black peach? Oh, that sounds terrible. Well, yes and no. And then we put little blackberries and we put peaches on the side, so a picture of it, so they understand it's blackberry and peach. So, you know. This is a few of the awards we won in the last 2 years. We've been pretty lucky, and I'm going to embarrass my son, but he told me one day, he said, are you just lucky or the other one's bad? So, and that's my favorite, you know, from him. And so you always got to chuckle. There wasn't a good answer there, so I kind of left it alone. The one on the far end is the ones we're most proud of, and that's Indianapolis. That's one of the biggest competitions in the U.S., and we're going against California, France, South America, Australian wines. There's 2,200 entries from that one, and we won the top fruit wine in the country from that competition. The last time a Kentucky winery won it was in 2006, and there's only been one other time, so it was 2006, so, and a friend of mine won it then. But so we've been pretty tickled with that. But we've been lucky. We've been lucky so far. This is just a recap. This is one of the things from that Indy operation. So, and we did that in a handout. But back again, it's marketing. You know, so. Sometimes my head will fit through the door. Sometimes it won't. So it just varies. And this is the other thing we get from that. So that's the Lawrence Blackberry. This is just a recap of some of the awards we've won in the last couple of years, so we keep updating this. The Kentucky Commissioner's Cup, that's the most important one we have in the state. It used to be the state fair one. They changed the name. The Department of Agriculture changed all that. So now we're actually going to have an award ceremony this October, which they've never done before. Some of the states do that. They're going to recognize some of the top wines, the top wineries, the top winemaker. So they're doing things like that, which helps further the industry, which we all need help on. This little t-shirt I come up with, we're always trying something different. We had the frog stand alone. We do purple, different colored t-shirts, things of that nature. And so I asked one of my insurers to do this for me, and this is what we ended up with. So it's something new. So we're always changing, adding. You always need something transitional. This is in the blue. I don't know if anybody knows this blue, but that's Kentucky blue. I'm sorry. I'm blessing that. State blue, I guess. This is an example of our Valentine's basket. We do a lot of different things, you know, so we try to meet the needs of the customers. And that's most of the pictures.
We have time for questions.
Back here.
I was just going to ask, which stores you sell at in Bowling Green?
We're in about half of them. We're in Liquor Barn, all four Chucks. We're in Shenanigans. We're in two of the Kroger's.
I-65.
Yeah, I-65 Liquors. They're all listed on our website.
Shamrock.
So there's a lot of them. We've been very lucky there.
Can you look at all the cafe at your convenience, please? Did you look at all the cafe at your
back
convenience?
Here?
Thank
no.
you.
Do you have another question?
Yeah, Rich. I have two questions.
Uh-huh.
Ryan said that you 25 acres, you're doing all this still on 25 acres, or did you increase
it? We buy a lot of fruit from others. You know, and everybody, a lot of people ask me how you do this. Well, the trick is buying good fruit. You can make a bad wine with good fruit, but you can't make a good fruit with bad wine. That's the trick. So we buy from a lot of other supplies. And that's the same way they do in Napa. You know, most of the Napa guys don't grow their own. All of it, or they grow part of it. Some of it they'll call state brands, things of that nature.
The second question, on your bottle filler, okay, you're using liquid nitrogen to blow out the oxygen.
Uh-huh.
When you do this by hand, are you playing with liquid nitrogen?
Yeah, we had it. It was in those canisters also, and there was a little, on the side of our little four-spout filler, there was a thing. You did the same thing. And essentially, it was a big rod and had a lever on it, and you just put it in there, and it blew the nitrogen.
Because that's pretty mean stuff.
Can be.
Yeah.
It's not liquid, though. It's gas.
It's gas. Yeah,
it's
this gas.
It's still cold.
Yeah. It's not, it's not like that. Yeah, like the real color. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Over here, John.
Good question. Is there anything that you can do with the waste that...
Yeah, your skins and seeds and all that. Some of the guys are taking the seeds. Of course, we don't have near enough. They're making oils out of them, things of that nature. But the skins and stuff, the compost. So what most of them do, especially in California or whatever, and we, you can put them in a compost pile, and they'll come back and refertilize their plants is what they do. So it's kind of self-sustaining.
And it seems like these wineries have kind of sprung up in the last 10 years. 15 years?
Yeah, there was around four or five of them 25 years ago. There's been a transition. We've kind of been in a holding pattern around 70 for the last 10 years. We had a bunch of guys who came in when the tobacco money was out there. Some of the guys got a little tobacco money. Because in general, what the state tries to push is you can, in the same amount of land, you can grow about the same dollar value with grapes as you could tobacco. So they were trying to get them to transition into that. But a lot of those guys started out early and didn't stay. And then we had several people that started when they were retirement age, and very soon they were unable to do the work. So we've had a transition. We keep adding, but we keep subtracting too, so we keep losing them. So it's been a challenge there. Yes?
So is there a difference in taste between glass bottles and plastic bottles with wine? I know with some kinds of alcoholic beverages there are differences.
I personally prefer the glass. The plastic to me is fine as long as it's not long term. I think alcohol with time will actually degrade the plastic, even if it's food grade 2, which is what they're after on the plastic. There's several guys that do actually make the wine in plastic. We only use stainless steel is our main thing. But several of the guys, as long as it's not long-term, I think it's all right. But long-term. I got a question for you guys. Which is a better closure, corks, synthetics, or screw top? Screw top. 1% of your, we use real core, so we're still using the old method. But corks have about 1% failure. So you get the leakage, they call it the cork tank, things of that nature. It's just a breakdown of cork. A lot of times they have, it's actually real wood. So it can be reharvested every 7 to 8 years. But they actually strip the bark, big layers, and it'll be about 2 inches thick. And they'll cut that. But actually, screw top's the best, long term. Some guys will argue about the breathing issue. They'll say a wine needs to breathe. Usually what that means is you put a wine in that's very astringent to start out. So essentially, you see the reds are 5 to 10 years old before you want to drink them. They make wines in two manners now in general. We make most of our wines to be drank within 1 year, 2 years max. But you can put a wine in there, it's very astringent, it's terrible. I mean, it's terrible. But after 5 or 6 years, it goes through a chemical reaction, and then it becomes a very good wine. But you've got to know you're going to do that from the start, because you got to start with a certain level of tannins and all these different stuff, so it's important. Uh-huh.
I've heard with cork wines, if you're going to store them for long term, to put them sideways, otherwise mm-hmm. they turn bitter. Is
yeah.
it the same with screw top?
No, screw top can be upright. In general, like I said, the cork, real cork is real wood. And what happens with it, if you leave wood out in the open, it'll dry out and crack. That's what cork does. You know, it just gets air. So what you want the fluid on the side of it, keeping it moist. And actually, the wine keeps it moist enough to keep it from cracking, you hope. The problem you find, you'll see it once in a while, they'll find a 200-year-old bottle or a box of them in some house stuck somewhere. The odds are it's not good. it's more likely, because what happened was that cork is dried up and disposed, and it's just, you know, it's turned to vinegar.
Do you have an opening event each year, a tasting?
We have free tastings every day. Every day to Sunday. We're not allowed to open Sundays yet. We're going to look at doing that in after November election. We've got a little thing sweet. But Kentucky passed a new law July 1st. Makes it, you can bring to a vote. Half of the Kentucky wineries have Sunday sales half down. Mostly the southern half do not.
Do you have
a
beginning of the season, first tasting?
First, you know, press and all that? We do not yet. I'm going to make him do that. Yeah. We thought about having the T-shirt thing. You've probably seen where some of the wineries take a red wine. They'll get in there and press it with their feet. And I think they rinse them off a little first. And then they'll have a T-shirt down, and you step on them. And, you know, which I'd like to do. I'd like to do in October, if we can. We're going to have a witches night. And it's an old European custom where... you bring a switch from your yard, and what was it, you know, 200-300 years ago, it was the burning of the witches. And what they did is everybody in the town would bring, you know, a few sticks out of their yard, and they'd have a big bonfire. And then they sit out and they drink. That's what they did. You know, they eat and drink. I just think that'd be neat to start something. So I've been doing a little research on that, so we might put a little steak, put a little something up. But I don't know. If we can get it all done in time, so... We're trying to get into Tennessee, and that's our challenge right now. So as soon as we get in there, increase our sales.
At what point does the winery become profitable? Obviously not the first year, or did it?
Year two. We're unusual. Yeah, most of the guys are still not profitable. Yeah. There's a lot of the guys who are still very small. Of that 70, there's probably about 12 to 15 of us that are actually thriving businesses, you know, generate that. So, but yeah, year two, I was pretty happy.
Yes, right here.
Have you ever done any wine with natural yeast?
We have, straight from harvest, and some of it was unintentional. You know, so what you end up having to do most of the time is the natural yeast is automatically on there. It's everywhere. But you'll take SO2, sulfur is what everybody uses in winemaking. And you try to kill the natural yeast. And the reasoning is that it's you never know if it's going to finish the wine completely. It may stop in the middle. Maybe halfway there. It can give off flavors. They have different nutrient requirements. You actually feed the yeast nitrogen and things like that. So you're like, you know, kind of like you do your plants. They use a different kind of nitrogen, but it's nitrogen. And yeast food. Yeah, on the box it says yeast food. But we tried some of that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. We've been pretty lucky. We've only had one small batch way back when it first started that didn't come out. But it could very easily happen.
Is the farmland that you're using, was it an established farm already, or were you starting from scratch?
No, we everything's from scratch. And a lot of people ask me how I learned. I read books. That's it. There was 3 or 4 books. I'll tell the guys how you do it. I'll tell them certain books. Some of them have a lot of chemistry in it, things of that nature. Tell you the number of molecules in sugar and all this different stuff. And I said, do you know how to use the sugar? And they go, yeah. I said, well, you don't need to know the formula. That's what the PhD guy does. If you don't understand it, just leave it alone. You don't need it. You know, that's not what we don't need that. That's what he does.
We got a few chemists here.
Yeah, yeah. He wrote the books, so let him deal with that. You know how to use it? We're good. Go for it.
Maybe time for one more question, and then we'll do our typical door prize. And we've got a couple T-shirts we'll give away. Yep. And we've got a couple from the library, and then we'll begin the tasting.
How does Very good. Sound? Yes. Very good.
One more question, anybody? Well, with that in mind, again, we want to thank you especially.
Thank you.